It is a privilege to be here. It really is. I think I'm right that Rich and I moved to this area about the same time, about 6 years ago, and God sent us to look after each other. and it is great. I love getting together with Rich. I love when you feel a Jesus connection with people from other traditions and streams and backgrounds. There's a richness in that for the kingdom, which is brilliant. And when you combine that with just an open-heartedness, that's good. But when you get a sharp creative thinker as well, that is magnificent. And if ever we find that, then that would be good. now I'm thinking, what does it do with my glasses? It's good, oh no. No. no, it is. It's a privilege to be here. I was saying to Rich earlier on, for me, what is an absolute joy is to have the opportunity to influence the influences in a church. And I think sometimes when you're younger and involved in ministry, you think, oh, I'm going to speak to a church of 80 people. I'm going to speak to a... But actually, if it's about influencing people and having the privilege of Jesus using you to help to shape lives, shape cultures, then influencing the influences in a church is absolutely wonderful. He was born in Canada. He grew up in a fairly obscure, out-of-the-way place. Parents were farmers. And so he didn't really have great and exciting things particularly planned for his life. Then when he was age 9 on TV, he watched Apollo 11 land on the moon. And he saw Neil Armstrong, a small step for man, but a giant step for mankind. He watched that on TV. And age 9, in the Canadian outback, he decided that he would become an astronaut. So age 9, he decided that everything that came in life, he would ask himself this question. What would a 9-year-old do who knows he's going to be an astronaut? Would he eat his greens and eat his proper dinners to keep him strong? Yeah. And as he grew, what would an 11-year-old do who knows he's going to become an astronaut? Well, actually, he would make sure he keeps fit. And as a 14-year-old, what would a 14-year-old do who knows he's going to become an astronaut? Well, he would make sure he works hard at school and passes exams. And that guy, as he grew, every age he was, he kept asking himself, what would a 15-year-old astronaut behave like? What would a 17-year-old astronaut behave like? What would a 19-year-old astronaut behave like? Bearing in mind that Canada had no space program and he's growing up in Canada. He carried on with that mindset. And you may have heard of him. Chris Hadfield is his name. Or as he's better known, Commander Chris Hadfield. Or as he's better known, the first Canadian in space. Or as he's better known, the man who has done 3 long stints in the space station. Or perhaps, as he's better known, the man who sang with the guitar Space Odyssey and sang David Bowie's song from where it should be sung, from outer space, ground control to Major Tom. He was gripped when he was 9 years old. And ever since then, Commander Chris Hadfield kept asking himself, if I'm going to make this decision, what would I do if I know I'm going to be an astronaut? We often talk about God's will. God's will is to do this, to do that, and it's what job you're going to get, and, you know, are you going to get married, and where are you going to live, and what's your call? Oh, for goodness sake. I'm sorry, I've been around long enough now. I'm tired of people seeking God for their call. Just do something and see what God blesses, you know. So we can just have so much time just getting us and get on with stuff, you know. And because I tell you what, God's will, more than anything, is about who we are becoming. It's about who we are becoming. And as a 9, 11, 12, 15, 18, 22, 27-year-old, he knew, I'm becoming an astronaut. And that was human ambition. But we're supposed to be full of the Holy Spirit and full of Jesus, remember? So we've got a little bit of extra going for us. And I want to encourage you to have at your core, what do I believe God's wanting me to become? That's God's will. And there's a scary thought for those of us in leadership. I'm going to do a bit of Bible tonight. I know that might be a surprise, a Pentecostal background, because it's all spirity stuff. But Luke 6, verse 40. Luke 6, verse 40. Very straightforward verse. It says, a student is not above his teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher. The Greek in here, you know, it's written Greek in Luke, good Greek in Luke. A student is actually the Greek word mathetes, which is usually translated disciple, a learner, a disciple. And so a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher. I don't know you, but I found that a little bit scary, because it's basically saying everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher. You're a person of influence. You're influencing. Now, you might be influencing kids, or people who don't yet follow Jesus, or adults, or women, or men, or particular small group, or whatever. But there's a scary thought in this Bible verse that people are going to become what you are. See, I don't like this verse. I wish this verse said, everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher, praise to be. Or, everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher, wishes to become. Everybody who is fully trained will be like his teacher, presents in public. But it doesn't say that. Just says going to be like his teacher. And so there's an awesome responsibility here, that if we have stepped up to responsibility and said, hey Jesus, please use me, and I'm sort of hoping that's your heart, I'm assuming that's your heart, because people who are prepared to do extra over and above the sort of, you know, the Sunday hobby Christians, sorry, I'm saying it as it is a little bit now, you know, but people who are stepping up beyond that usually say, hey Jesus, use me. And I want to encourage you to continue to set your heart to say, what's Jesus helping me to become? And help me to cooperate with what the Spirit's doing to help me to become that. Partly for your sake, because my prayer would be for you and for me, we're going to become the very best disciple of Jesus we can be. But also, if we're involved in influencing others, teacher in this sense, in the widest sense, there's others who are going to become the same as us. Which is both incredibly humbling and actually quite annoying. I don't know about you, but I got kids. I got three kids. My eldest kid, who gave me the best Father's Day present ever. I couldn't believe it. On Monday, he treated me and took me down to London. And we went to a show together and came back. Brilliant. He's 29 now. It's about time I got a Father's Day present. But the fascinating thing is, he's my eldest. And I'll never forget, me and him were having a bit of a row, you know, like you do. I know you know that vicars don't ever have rows and domestic issues and stuff, but pastors in Pentecostal churches do. That's different, you know. And me and Tim were just having this ding-dong. And Tim was probably, at the time, he's probably 18, 19. And so we were just having this sort of blokey-type ding-dong, you know. And I can't remember what it was about. And I was saying this, and we were in the kitchen. Now, Johnny is 2 years younger, his brother. And Johnny's the most chilled, laid-back, easygoing person you could ever imagine. He got interviewed for a job, traffic control, air traffic control, and he says, how do you cope with stress? And he says, I don't know, I've never really been stressed. And that's true. Now, they didn't believe him at the interview, which didn't help, but he's so mega chilled. Anyway, so me and Tim, big brother, are going for it in the kitchen, and suddenly we both become aware of Johnny stood in the corner. And eventually was, what? And Johnny smiled at the two of us, right? This is like dad and big brother. He says, I just think you're both as bad as each other. And walked off. And as he walked off, you know, we thought, he's right. He's absolutely right. Because most of the time when Tim was growing up, and I was telling him off, I was telling him off because he's behaving just like me. Which is very annoying. And the truth is, people become what we model. I've been around church now for quite a while. You know, I've realized the people who influenced me most when they least realized it. Which probably means that when you set yourself to intentionally be an influence, you might have minimal influence. But when you just are you, and people are watching, you're influencing. It's especially scary for parents. Now our kids are sort of 29, 27, and 20... What's that be? 23. She's one of the youth leaders in a church in Cheltenham you might have heard of. Anyway. And, nicked her. No. But the fascinating thing is you just see the development of your kids. And as they get older, it is shocking when you realize they were listening when they were 6 and when they were 8, when they were 10. And I remember the time when you and Mum had that row about, how did you know that? We were just listening in the other room. So I just want to encourage you Set your heart to become who Jesus wants you to become, but recognize it's for your sake, but it's also influencing others. We become, people around us become who we are, you know. And then I want to take us to a scripture. I'm only going to do three scriptures, don't worry, I know it's a big book. 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Probably the second New Testament letter written, I'm guessing. And Thessalonica was a pretty decent church to go to. They got their eschatology a little bit wrong, but they were a pretty decent church. And just one verse from 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8. So Paul says to the guys of Thessalonica, we, that means Paul, Silas and Timothy, we loved you so much that we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well, because you had become so dear to us. We loved you so much that we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well, because you had become so dear to us. There's loads in that I'd love to unpack, but there's just two things I want to focus on. How does the verse begin and end? We loved you so much, and it ends, because you'd become so dear to us. The guy who influenced me tremendously is nearly 80 now. I talked to him last weekend. He and I thought he'd be in heaven 20 years ago, but he's still going strong. He's had a quadruple bypass, and everything that can get bypassed has been bypassed. But he took a risk and asked me to be his assistant when I was 23. To be his assistant pastor, I knew what I was like when I was 23, you know? But I'm just absolutely astonished that he loved people. And he loved people in Jesus' name. And I'll never forget, as we began to work together, I learnt that ministry is about people. And he gave me a Christmas card once. And it was a normal Christmas card, but inside it was a plaque for my desk. And it just said, "Don't forget, it's about the people, dummy." It was nice of me, wasn't it? And I put that on my desk in the office. Because you see, if we're not careful, we forget it's about people. It's about people. See, we talk about being people of influence, which is what leadership is. But the reason that Paul and Silas and Timothy had a measure of influence in the church at Thessalonica is that people knew that these guys love them. And it's a very simple principle, but it's one we miss at our peril. You cannot lead what you do not love. You cannot lead what you do not love. You can cajole, you can manipulate, you can maneuver, you can browbeat. There's loads of things you can do, but you cannot genuinely lead with spiritual authority what you do not love. And here he said, we loved you so much. And at the end of the verse, you had become so dear to us. You cannot lead what you do not love. And it's one of those things that it's weird when we talk about leadership being influence. Sometimes people, I think, misinterpret that and think, okay, leadership is influence. I mean, if I'm called to have a measure of leadership in the church or in any other sphere, I decide that I will influence people. But actually, the complete reverse is true. I don't decide who I will influence. Let's pick on Laura just because it's easy. She's done it before, so well. So if I say, I know, I'm going to decide, I will influence you. Whoa. It don't work that way. What decides that whole dynamic is, and this is where the analogy goes wrong, Laura recognizing something in me and thinks, actually, I want that person to influence me. See, it goes from the other end. And we have in the church often far too much positional leadership. Because I have such and such a position, you should respect that. The whole world's changed. It's not just about church. This whole thing of authority and leadership has changed. I remember my mum, when I was about 10, every single Friday night, after we'd had our fish and chips, we always had to have fish, actually fish fingers usually, because we were good Catholics, no we weren't. We had fish fingers and chips and baked meats. And we'd always have to huddle and scuttle up afterwards, because my mum has to hoover the house. Well, just the downstairs. I think, where'd you get a hoover down? Because I know the pastor in the church does his visits on a Friday night. So we had to hoover in case the pastor came. Thinking, what's that all about? You know? And I think my parents' generation, anybody who said something in a suit was to be obeyed. You know, if you go to a hospital, anybody with a white coat, you've got to obey everything they say. Well, the whole of society has shifted now. So a doctor said something or other. I'm not sure. I know I Googled it last night and it said on Wikipedia. Whoa, the whole basis of that has shifted. And I grew up in an environment where it would be said, well, as your pastor, I tell you. And in those days it worked. It's not going to work now. Not at all. Not so much because church has changed, but society has changed. The basis of authority has changed. And therefore, it's incumbent on us, if we believe that God has called us not to be an astronaut, perhaps, but to have a measure of leadership influence in his church for his kingdom's sake, we need to recognize that people are going to become what we are. But if we intend to have influence, we don't decide it, they decide it. They decide whether we are worthy of allowing some influence to go from us to them. That is the way leadership works. And that starts off by loving. Funny enough, I'm thinking of Dave Playle, because we talked last week, the guy who's nearly 80 now. And boy, he was tough on me. He was really tough. I'll never forget the time when we were very, very first beginning to work together a little bit. I was called pastor's assistant, because I've never been a fan of titles. I didn't want to be assistant pastor. I'm 23. I never wanted to have the uniform so big it was like, you know. So I was pastor's assistant, been working with him for about 6 or 9 months. And I'll never forget, I've been on Operation Mobilization, and I'd done OM for several summers, and I was ready to go to Turkey again and Yugoslavia. Rah. And he said, do you want to come and work in the church with me? And I said, no, it sounds so boring. It really does. Nevertheless, somehow or other, God turned my heart. You know, it's annoying when it happens, isn't it? Anyway, God turned my heart. You know, the Psalm 37. And so I said, come with you. And I remember taking my Thompson Chain Reference Bible and my Strong's Concordance. I remember taking them with me on my first day for summer. I thought they could be handy. These are like what, you know, pastor's assistant's supposed to have. I spent the next 8 weeks repairing broken windows in the church building. I do. We were in a really rough part of Manchester, Longsight, if you know Manchester at all. Even the police went round in like fives. But the fascinating thing was, he was really tough with me. But you know what? I knew he loved me. And during that time, he came to me once, and he says, has anybody ever talked to you about smelling? I says, what do you mean smelling? He says, you know, about B.O. Well, oddly enough, not really, no. Oh. He says, I bought you something, and gave me the squirty deodoranty stuff, you know, one of them girly ones. The girly pink shirt man. One. and you know, the fascinating thing was, we just had that conversation. I thought, oh, thank you. You know. And it was about 3 or 4 years later that I forget even why it was happening. We had the conversation. And I took Dave back to that. I said, you were the only person who ever told me about that, you know. And he says, you didn't have any problem with it at all. I said, what? He says, I just really knew that God was calling me to ask you to work as my assistant, and I wanted to just see what your reaction and your attitude would be. Isn't that interesting? What a devious! Eventually, I became his assistant pastor, worked with him for about 6 years, and then, funny enough, we did what we did just done here at Lifehouse, where we reversed the whole thing. And so I'd been on Dave's team, then I became the senior leader, Dave was on my team. It's funny, isn't it? It's great to repeat what you were mentored in. It's wonderful. But I knew that Dave loved me. I knew that Jesus loved me. That's right. So I received that. And I could tell you half a dozen things when he challenged me. When Jill and I were going out together, he used to just say, so, how are you doing sexual intimacy? Any problems? Really? Never forget. He says, because if there's no problems at all, I'd be worried about you getting married. He says, but you've got to watch the problems as well. We had some really direct, strong, straight-talking stuff. But you know what? I knew he loved me and wanted the best for me. You cannot lead what you do not love. I'm tempted to pause and ask you to talk about that, but let's move on a little bit, because I want to get you talking to each other. Are you sat next to somebody you'll be able to talk to in a minute? Would you mind? If you want to move now. Because the middle of the verse we haven't covered yet. We will love you so much that we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. Boy, oh boy. If we are going to have any influence today in people's lives, we We cannot just share the gospel of God. We've got to share our lives. This is about life sharing. It really is. Because what Jesus does in the lives of others is often the overflow of what he's doing in our life. Nearly every message I've ever preached, I've had to do whatever I'm asking people to do at the end of it. I've had to do that beforehand. Because God often works through the overflow. And here he says, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. The challenge with that is it involves letting people close. And this is where I'm going to ask the question. How good are you at allowing people to get close? Some people find that quite intimidating. But the truth is, if we want to build trust, we've got to disclose of ourselves. And we've got to allow people close to us. That could be quite intimidating. And let me take you to the last verse we're going to look at. And then I'm going to ask you to talk about it. This is 2 Corinthians. Same thing, really. Except Paul's talking to Corinth. There's a church you don't want to pastor. 2 Corinthians, end of chapter 6. Now, there's a little bit that I'm not going to read it all, but some of you probably would know it. It's the bit in chapter 6, verse 14, where it says, do not be yoked together with unbelievers, for what do righteousness and weakness have in common? It's the sort of thing that's handy if you talk to a young man, young woman, wanting to go out with somebody who's not a Christian. It's that type of verse, you know. But the whole chunk there, from 2 Corinthians 6, 14, where it says, do not be yoked, to the end of chapter 7, verse 1, is often in commentators will tell you that's in brackets. It's like a little chunk that's in brackets. So we have to look at what's before it and what's after it. If that's in brackets, what's before and what's after? And so let's go back to verse 11. So this is 2 Corinthians 6:11. We have spoken freely to you, Corinthians, and opened wide our hearts to you. We are not withholding our affection from you, but you're withholding yours from us. As a fair exchange, I speak as to my children. Wow, that's powerful. Open wide your hearts also. Then he does the bit in brackets. Don't be unequally yoked. Then look at verse 2 of chapter 7 after the brackets. Make room for us in your hearts. What Paul is saying here to the church in Corinth is, we've spoken freely to you guys. We've opened wide our hearts to you. We're not withholding anything from you, but you're withholding yours from us. Please, it's a fair exchange. Open wide your hearts. And he goes on the rant about the don't be unequally yoked, and then he lands it in verse 2, next chapter, make room for us in your hearts. So here's the challenge. If we are expecting God to use us to have influence in those around us, in leadership, which is what it is, how good are you at opening up your heart? So I'm going to ask you to talk about that a little bit with the person next to you. You can do it in twos, you can do it in three if you want. I feel very safe in like an Anglican or a Baptist environment, because if I say, please do it with two or three, you'll probably do that. You do this with blinking Pentecostals, you get nines and sevens and, oh goodness sake. So with a two or a three, okay, that's you with one other or you with two others. Here's the challenge I'm going to say, right? Some people are naturally the sort of people that just wear their heart on their sleeve. They're just naturally quite open. And sometimes they've got to learn to rein that in a bit. One of my greatest friends and mentors, although he would never use that word, for many years, he's now with Jesus, a guy called Ken, he fairly often said to me, Pete, you need to hold it in a little bit. I don't know why, whether it's the northern thing going on, my dad was like that. I just say how it is, you know, just... And I've had to learn to rein it in a little bit. But I have to say, although I've had to learn to rein it in, I believe God uses that openness to build trust. Because if you're disclosing of yourself, the tendency is for people to be able to trust that. Whereas if somebody's a little bit more guarded, a little bit more shy, it's not just about being introverted, it's just a guarded sort of find it harder to disclose. That is a challenge because it's harder for people to trust themselves. And that's what Paul is saying both to Thessalonica and to Corinth. Thessalonica, he said, we shared with you our lives. You just get the feeling they were so open, so vulnerable, so honest. They shared that. And to Corinth, he says, we opened wide our hearts. Please open wide your hearts. Then he says it again. Open wide your hearts. And he says it again. Make room for us in your hearts. So here's the question. If there is a spectrum between people who say too much about themselves and people who don't say enough, which end of the spectrum are you likely to be towards? Okay? Are you a sharer too often person, or do you tend to hold it in and you don't say a lot? Okay? So find somebody you don't like, and just for 3 or 4 minutes, just answer that question. Are you a guarded person? Or are you a sharing too much person? Which end of the spectrum would you be on? Okay? So let's go for that, and then we'll have some feedback in a minute. Anybody want to tell a little bit of feedback? What did you learn from that little discussion? Trust.
So as soon as trust enters the equation, the default in sharing shifts.
That's interesting. So would that mean it's a very conscious decision to trust?
I think it would be more a kind of... That it's not necessarily a reluctance to share generally, but more a willingness to. But we both found ourselves using the word trust.
Interesting.
That shifts the dynamic in.
Okay.
How deeply you share.
Okay, that's good. Thanks. Anybody else? Yeah.
Yeah, it's the family dynamics, but when you're growing up, it's a big difference.
Yeah, that's good. Just unpack that a little bit then.
Well, for myself and Tim as well, growing up, we were kind of a lot more reserved, and just because of other people being more dominant in conversation and talking.
Yeah. I was going to say, do you want to say any more on that, Tim? But the answer is probably going to be no, really, isn't it?
same as Russ, I think. Because my family, I've got 4 elder sisters. And the 3 eldest were the dominant force within the house.
Right.
So me and the younger sister, at the dinner table or in the living room watching the TV, it was always the 3 elder girls that got to choose what was on TV.
Is that right?
But even now, when we get together as a wider family unit, we subconsciously resume the same roles that we have always grown up
with. Okay.
Naturally.
Isn't that interesting? Those 2 words say it all, the dominant force.
Yes.
I like that. Anybody else? What you learnt from just your little bit of dialogue between the 2 or 3 of you? I don't want to put anybody on the spot particularly, but anybody want to be honest about whether you share too much or don't share enough? Or?
I think we've both had a very similar view, but the more vulnerable you become by opening up, the more... I don't think we really use the word trust, but the more trusting people became, the more likely that they would be to open up as well.
So
the more you open up, the more other people will open up.
Yeah. Now, I would certainly want to make a case for that, but I'm up for anybody disagreeing, apart from Rich, because he's my friend. But I would certainly want to make that case that, and I see that in practice, where leaders are expecting to have influence, but because they're quite guarded in opening up, they wonder why people don't trust them. And then they can be almost appeared to be sort of almost nosy, because they're trying to sort of dig something out. And somebody's inwardly, maybe not necessarily very self-aware of what they're doing, but they're inwardly sort of saying, well, why should I open up to them? They ain't opened up to me, which is the Corinth thing. So anybody want to, I totally agree with you, but anybody want to sort of disagree with that or unpack that a bit more? Or? Yeah. I could. I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you an open upper?
Oh, I'm a real open
upper. Well
done. I don't
done.
Think I'm a particularly good example as a Christian. For example, okay. I opened up to my group as a group leader that I have quite major problems with doubt. But I don't know that it really helped the group, so I'm not sure it was the best thing to say.
Well, I'm just going to say something in a minute that will support that, actually.
But, and you could talk about, sins and all sorts, and is it going to encourage? It depends where other people are at. There might be a new Christian, you might be walking down the
Depends. Yeah, you see, I knew I'd have to shut you up eventually. depends whether discipleship's a moment or a journey. Because I just want to support you. And I'm an open upper. And I think that therefore I recognize, I hope this doesn't sound smarmy, but I know that down the years, God has been able to use a measure of influence through me to help others in a situation, but it could only have happened if they trusted me. And they trusted me because I opened up. I'm sort of warts and all. What you see is what you get. I like it, I lump it, sort of thing. But I agree with what you said a minute ago, that those of us at that end of the spectrum, we've got to learn context, we've got to learn timing, we've got to learn... See, I'm a open up very readily, and I'm married a very closed, don't say much. And because of the context of our church, and Jill and I, within about 4 or 5 months of being married, we were actually doing marriage counselling for people, pre-marriage counselling, because we had about, I think I married about 4 or 5 people, if you know what I mean, the summer after we were married. So Jill and I are doing this premarital counselling, and of course, so we're there doing this, and I think number 3 was the sex talk and having discussion about, and so I'm saying, oh yeah, yeah, when we went on our honeymoon night was a right mess, it was a right, oh yeah. So I'm saying, oh listen, Jill's like, that, you know. So I learned very quickly that if you're an open upper, you've got to learn to rein it in sometimes, you know. So I learned to say, we know a young couple who on their honeymoon. So what I'm saying is I think there's strength in it, but it does need reining in. Last comment from anybody in case... Yeah?
So I work with the kids in our church, and I'm definitely an open upper, partly because I'm an external processor, so I have to talk through my feelings.
Yeah, you don't know what you think till you say it. Yes, I'm there.
but the kids would know if I was not being honest and transparent.
Yeah.
And so I think they...
Interesting. Thank you. Henri Nouwen. He's a Catholic, but we've got to get over that. If there's 10 books I would say to anybody to read on leadership, this would be one. It's a different type of book on leadership. In the Name of Jesus, it's called. In the Name of Jesus. Henri Nouwen, if you know his writing at all, is a heart and soul type person. His writing speaks to your heart and soul, not to your head. There's loads of great leadership head books. That's brilliant. Loads of them. But Henri Nouwen, In the Name of Jesus, Reflections on Christian Leadership. Let me just read this. Ministry is not only a communal experience, it is also a mutual experience. All two-way. Jesus, speaking about his own shepherding ministry, says, I am the good shepherd. I know my own and my own know me, just as the Father knows me and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for my sheep. As Jesus ministers, so he wants us to minister. He wants Peter to feed his sheep and care for them, not as professionals who know their clients' problems and take care of them, but I love this, but as vulnerable brothers and sisters who know and are known, who care and are cared for, who forgive and are being forgiven, who love and are being loved. Somehow, we have come to believe that good leadership requires a safe distance from those we are called to lead. Our Lord never modeled that. Neither did Paul here. We opened up our hearts. We shared with you our very lives. Then he continues a little bit later. Laying down your life means making your own faith and doubt, your own hope and despair, your own joy and sadness, your own courage and fear available to others as ways of them getting in touch with the Lord of life. We are not the healers. We are not the reconcilers. We are not the givers of life. We are sinful, broken, vulnerable people who need as much care as anyone we care for. The mystery of ministry is that we have been chosen to make our own limited and conditional love the gateway for the unlimited and unconditional love of God. True ministry must be mutual. I love that. That's helped to shape my thinking, shape my life, shape my ministry when I read that some years ago. Because it's two-way. And it only works that two-way, that open-heartedness. Now, I want to finish, and you can have a few final thoughts on this, but some of you may have seen this. It's used in all sorts of different contexts. The Joe Harry window, does that ring bells with you? Well, you will have seen it. The Joe Harry window. It has lots of spins on it, lots of approaches. So I'm probably going to be putting my spin on it. So, at the top of here, I'm going to put... you. Okay? You. Now, it gets better, don't worry. In here, I am also gonna put you. Then I'm going to put in here known and unknown. And then I'm going to realise I shouldn't have put you in here. I'm going to put in here, I thought that didn't look long enough. I'm going to put in here significant other. Significant other. So let me unpack this first. If you think about it, there are certain things in your life that are known to you and certain things that are unknown to you. And so these two categories here are going to represent stuff that's known to you and stuff that's unknown to you. So let's just hold that thought, put it on pause for a minute. And then in here, I'm going to put known again and unknown. But this time, these categories across here are going to say we each have significant others. Okay? One of the things that my wife hates is, you know, if anybody phones you and they say, is your significant other there? She hates that partner thing. My husband, you know. So we're not just talking about spouse, or if you're married, hopefully your spouse will be in here. Your spouse should be significant to you. But we're really saying that this category means anybody whose opinion of you matters to you. Okay? The significant other is anybody whose opinion of you matters to you. And to the significant other, in other words, somebody who knows you and somebody whose opinion of you matters to you, they have certain things that they know about you, and there's certain things that's unknown by them about you. So this is about you knowing and unknowing, and this is about a significant other, a really good friend, if you like, and what they know and don't know about you. Now, if we begin to fill this in a little bit, makes a bit more sense. Here is very obvious, because this is something that's just public. It's just open, if you like. This quadrant here represents something that you know about yourself, and the significant other knows it as well. So when a good friend of mine says, you know, you do need to lose at least a stone, if not 2 stone, and possibly a little bit more, then that's wounding, but actually it's known, it's in the public domain. You can only breathe in so much. So it's something that's just known. So it's known to me, and it's known to my significant other. But it gets a bit more interesting here, because this is something that is unknown to me, but is known to my significant other. And we probably... Any thoughts? What might go in there? We probably would call it a blind spot. We'd probably call it a blind spot. Because what we're saying here is that this represents those areas of my life that I don't know about. But my significant other does. Many years ago, I was working in architecture, and I worked in a particular environment for a while where we sold joint office supplies to other architects as well. So we had this big warehouse, and at the front of the warehouse was the shop. And the shop had 3 or 4 ladies working in it, and they were sort of dealt with public. But then in the back, there were 2 guys who were sort of 16, 17-year-olds who did all the humping around of all the papers and machines and all the rest of it. And the ladies came to me, right? Bearing in mind, I'm just about, by then I'm proper assistant pastor. I'm like 28 or something like that, 29 perhaps. And they came to me and says, do you know one of the guys, one of the young fellas who works in the warehouse, he smells. He really hums. He pongs. And one of the ladies says, you're training to be a vicar. She said that. You're funny being accused of that. You're training to be a vicar. Can you have a word with him? And I'm thinking, why is it part of the pastoral ministry role to tell people they smell? I had no idea that in many ways you spend the next 25 years doing exactly that, but just in different ways, spiritually, metaphorically. And so I had to go and chat to this guy. We had a chat with him, and it's funny, it was a bit like what Dave Playl had modelled to me a few years before. But you see, it was a blind spot. It was a blind spot. It was unknown to him. But boy, it was known to the ladies. You ever met anybody whose breath smells? It's one of those things, isn't it? Hello, you know, and you think, oh, I hope to goodness there's somebody who loves them enough to tell them. But you see, the truth is, other people know, but you don't know. Let's go to this one, which is the opposite way around. In this area, we're saying it's something that you know, but it's something that others, the significant others, don't know. And you probably in here would want to say something like private. So it's unknown to the significant other, but it's known to you. So, this is going back a few years, because Tim and Johnny are now 29 and 27, so it must be something like 20 years ago. And I was working as a pastor, gone full-time for a few years, I guess, and Mondays was my day off. Now, Jill was a hairdresser, and I remember on Monday going to the video shop. This was something called VHS videos, okay? You had to go to shops to get films. You couldn't go on that webby cloudy thing. And I remember going to this shop on the Monday, and I went to get a couple of Thomas the Tank Engine. You know, Ringo Starr, Thomas the Tank Engine. So I went to get a couple of Thomas the Tank, so we could watch them with the lads, because the lads and me, I mean, the lads were really into Thomas the Tank. And I never forget, and this is bizarre, isn't it? But I remember crouching down, looking at Thomas the Tank, because they're all there for the kids. And as I stood up, I am quite tall, and eye level with what I guess would be described as adult videos. And I'm looking at these adult videos, thinking, oh my life. And I remember looking and thinking, what's she wearing? The answer was not a lot. And I remember picking it off the shelf, thinking, oh my goodness, what a title. And turning over, and guess what? She was wearing even less on the back. And it flashed into my mind. There's nobody home. It's just a laugh. It's not like I'm going down a brothel or anything. It's just a guy. Oh, and I'm working hard for Jesus. And, you know, you need a bit of therapy. It's just a laugh. It's just a giggle. And so I toyed with that type of thinking. And I'll never forget, somehow or other, something from Sunday school, something about Joseph running away, or something like that came to me. And I'll never forget running to the counter and putting this video and the two Toms the Tank Engines on the counter and running out of the shop. I dread to think what they thought of me with two Toms. Anyway, that's just... And I ran out of the shop. Now, I'd love to say that was the end of the story, but unfortunately it wasn't. That night we had our team meeting, our elders meeting at night. And at the time, I don't believe in this necessarily, but at the time it was an all-male leadership team. Just happened to be that. And the funny thing was, I started the meeting and started saying to people, hey, we're going to get into the agenda, we've got to discuss this, this and this. And the guy said to Kevin, who actually now pastors the church, he was an elder with me and he now leads the church in Stockport. And I'll never forget, Kevin said, hey Pete, hang on, you don't usually get into the business, you always say it's important to just be sort of brothers in Jesus and talk about how we're doing. And he said these words, how's your day been? Oh. And I decided to say, hey, I need to tell you guys what happened. Anyhow, they reported me to Assemblies of God. I got defrocked and thrown out. No, I didn't. They let me talk about that temptation, that toying, that in my head. Thankfully, I hadn't gone beyond that. Because the truth is, you're never going to go somewhere physically that you haven't gone to mentally quite a few times before. And they prayed with me. And then at the end, they said, which one of us do you want us to talk to you about every fortnight and say, hey, what type of things have you been watching? That was very practical. Didn't just the prayer bit, but the challenge. You see, I had to make a decision that what was private actually could have become secret. But I made a decision. And the truth is that if you put these two together, blind spot recovery is about learning to listen to others and getting rid of the private, the secret ones is learning, I suppose you could say, to talk, or let's say to disclose. And if we had time, we timed out, but if we'd had time, I would have said to you, how good are you at listening to somebody who comes to point out a blind spot in your life? Or how good are you at voluntarily disclosing to somebody else, to a significant other, something that's difficult? Because the truth is, arrogant people have no significant others. Insecure, fragile people have far too many. We each need a handful here. My journey has been learning to just have a few people who have the right to speak into me. When I was younger, I would be troubled by too many people. I would be thinking, oh! No, I've learned to reduce this to a small number of people whose opinion of me matters to me. But arrogant people have nobody there. Who cares? And the beauty in here is, just for the sake of finishing off the thing here, here you could say, well, it's non-existent. No, it's not that it's non-existent. It's that often things are hidden. And you get hidden potential that that can be released in people's lives. Because as you, it's unknown to you and it's unknown to them, and slowly you discover things. A young woman in our church in Stockport, I won't tell you her name, but she had a very, very traumatic, tragic upbringing, lots of things with uncles and dad, and very, very, very traumatic. Very slight, very fragile. And one time she was chatting to my wife, and my wife Jill, she said, "I can't do anything." My wife was determined. That's a challenge to her. So she got chatting with this young woman, found out she could write. She could write stuff. So she said, "Well, there's an old lady in the church. Would you like to write to her?" "Oh, okay." So she wrote letters to this old lady in the church who was housebound, couldn't get out. This old lady came to me and says, "Oh yes, every Monday morning I get the chair and I go down and I wait for the letter to come from her. And I get the cup of tea and listen." And she did that. And eventually she came and says, "Can I write to anybody else?" Good friend of mine was a guy called Noel Proctor, who was a chaplain in Strangeways Prison, Manchester then. So this young woman started writing to prisoners. She started getting like 15 letters a week. And then eventually she got part of the little team that put our church bulletin thing together. And then we moved on from the church. A few years ago, my mum had a significant birthday. She's still in the church. We went back up, had this big birthday thing. And this young woman came up to me and she said, "Peter, I've got a present for you." I said, "Yeah, what's that?" She says, "My first book of published poems." Same young woman who said she couldn't do anything. Hidden potential. It just came out of somebody like my wife who had the time to just tease out the unknown. Hidden potential. So this isn't just about stopping being naughty. It's about incredible potential that come out of us. So if we had time, I'll leave you to do this for homework. I would want to ask you, the next question would be, how are you when people come and challenge you about blind spots? Because that's part of discipleship, especially if you're a leader. Do you fly off the handle? Do you listen to everything that everybody says? Whoa! See, we've got to learn to critically evaluate constructive criticism that comes to us. So how good are you at listening? Because the better we're able to listen to significant, supportive friends, the better we are going to be able to get rid of blind spots. But what about voluntarily disclosing stuff that you're struggling with? Because people are going to become who we are. And if we learn to disclose, as that expands and as that expands, who knows what hidden potential can be released in their lives and in our lives. So may you become the very best person Jesus could ever help you to become for the sake of you and others in his kingdom. Sorry, I've overrun, mate. There you go. Bless you.
Can we say thank you to Pete?